This is another episode of Connecting the Dots podcast. I'm Skip Steward, Vice President and Chief Improvement Officer at Baptist Memorial Healthcare.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brad Parsons, Vice President of Market Operations at Baptist.
And I'm Bill Cloud, Assistant Chief Medical Officer at Baptist.
Well, folks, we have a fantastic guest today. We have Keith Ferrazzi, and he is an author of many books, but today we're going to talk about his book, the new one called Never Lead Alone, 10 Shifts from Leadership to Teamship. Welcome, Keith. And if you would, tell our audience a little bit about your background.
Skip, thanks so much. So a poor kid from Pittsburgh grew up in the crash of the steel industry of the 70s. I made a commitment back then to make sure to study the efficacy, the how organizations work, because I saw and was a victim of a very arrogant big industry called the U.S. steel industry that hadn't kept up with the times. And so I've spent a lifetime on that focus. I've been blessed to have some really cool jobs. I was the chief marketing officer of Deloitte. I was a part of that early team that started Starwood Hotels and Resorts. I was chief marketing officer and head of sales at Starwood Hotels. But for the last 20 years, I've run a research institute focused on high-performing teams. And I have sat in the room with Jeff Bezos's team. I have understood what Jamie Dimon's team at JP Morgan and what they do to be successful. And I've studied healthcare. So we're here to tell you today to talk about what we should do to expect more from teams. And I couldn't be happier.
Hey, Keith, thanks so much for joining the podcast, Connecting the Dots. We talk a lot about healthcare improvement, continuous improvement, performance improvement for our teams. And you kind of mentioned before coming on the air that you got a passion for healthcare. So we're very lucky to have you. I'm wondering if you will tell us why you said yes today.
Well, first of all, I have a passion for two things. I am deeply passionate around continuous improvement and process improvement. My first job out of school was, you know, TQM, Six Sigma, Total Quality Management, and ultimately became a black belt, a judge of the Baldrige Award. I've always been focused on how every single day the folks at the coal face of the work can improve their day-to-day efforts. And in healthcare, obviously, look, when you get to be 60 years old like I am, you start to care a lot more about longevity than you do about anything else. So my commitment to healthcare, and I believe its service to society, also on a personal basis, I'm a bit of a health nut. And I'm very excited about being here. And I would always say yes to an institution as great as yours.
Keith, are there any differences between healthcare and other industries that you take into account when you talk about improvement?
You know, it's interesting because I think in some ways, healthcare, like sports teams, in different places, like if you really think about the best performing teams, you don't have to teach a sports team on how to be a great team. They've been weaned since they were kids on how to make sure they learn to pass the ball, not hog it to themselves. They had to learn that the team gives each other energy, that the team gives each other critique. It's not just the captain or the coach at halftime. It's the team coaching each other. My studies over 20 years have discovered the fact that the team has to take responsibility for some degree of leadership along with the leader. That's why I talk about teamship as something that we need to be focused on. Leaders need to learn that they need to be expecting more from teams. Now, the work you all have done in operating rooms and making sure that people have a full voice during procedures, all members of that team, and we're not just looking up at the hierarchy. We knew what it was like back in the day when an ER nurse or an operating nurse didn't have a voice, and that we realized you'd get better outcomes once the whole team could participate. I think you've probably clinically gone further than what you need to do perhaps on the business side of things. Because my suspicion is we still have those silos and we still have that hierarchy when it comes to the business side of healthcare. And we need to take some of the lessons we've learned in clinical and bring it over.
Bill, right out of the gate, man, he's talking OR. That's your speed, right?
That's right. I'm starting to get scared, man.
So I love, Keith, I love the quick nod to teamship. I want you to unpack a little bit more about leadership versus teamship and how you think about that.
I don't think leaders have been, have been coached and trained on how to build high-performing teams. Most leaders are taught how to be highly accountable for a set of outcomes, how to give individuals feedback, how to hold individuals accountable, right? Now, what I'm coming along and saying is a great leader puts more of the pressure on the team and says, hey, wait a second. If we're going to be a great team, you've got to give each other feedback. You've got to hold each other accountable. You've got to keep care, take care of each other's energy. It's not all on the shoulders of the leader. The average manager and the average leader has very little time to take care of everybody. But if they create a social contract where the team takes care of each other, that's game changing. That's the difference between traditional leadership, which is often hierarchical and top down, and what I call high performing teams and teamship, where the leader coaches the team to step up.
You mean you don't want to, we don't need leaders to be heroes or firefighters?
You know, that's certainly the old John Wayne rugged individualism mindset that we always had, right? And I would imagine to a great extent, healthcare has been burdened by that, by the way in which we educate healthcare professionals, right? We educate them to be the ones that step in and save the day. I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert on how healthcare education works, but in the early days of healthcare education, I suspect there's not a lot of teaching on how to build a high-performing team. It's probably very clinical, and it's about, you know, and probably those individuals who got to that presence where they can get a doctor's degree and get a medical degree, a nursing degree, they got there because they studied their individual butts off, right? Now, all of a sudden, we turn around and we say, now we got to teach you how to work in the team. And I suspect to some extent that coaching comes in internships, perhaps. Maybe if you're at a good teaching hospital where that internship happens, I don't know. But, you know, where is it that we teach how to get the most out of the team? I think that has been under-curated in most professions. I don't pretend to be as experts as y'all are, but I suspect there's a big difference between what happens in that big building where all the people who are working in the offices act and what's happening down at the clinical setting.
Let me ask you a related question, because Brad and I talk about this all the time. The way leadership emerges day-to-day in a hospital, for example, is there might be someone who is a really good clinical nurse on a unit. And so the assumption is that they're really a good nurse, so they should probably be a manager. We should make them a manager and a leader. So how should we be making those decisions? And if we identify someone, how do we handle them so that they actually do become a good leader?
Yeah, I think you've really hit on it. You know, that's always called the Peter Principle, right? Where you take somebody who has shown expertise at one level and then you bump them up into management. I joked that, you know, at Deloitte, I was chief marketing officer at a crazy young age. I was less than 30, and I was the global chief marketing officer at Deloitte. I always joked that they prematurely threw me into overhead before I knew what the heck I was doing. Look, I think we need to look at what are the competencies of that kind of the kind of leader we're talking about. Who can bring people together? You know, I wrote a book called Leading Without Authority a few years ago, and the opening chapter is about an ER nurse who wants to transform the ER and is trying to figure out how do they, without the authority to do so, how do they marshal the team in order to elevate the ER? I think the first question is this person shown effectiveness in collaborating and getting the best out of other people, right? Has this person shown the ability to create a vision but not be hierarchical about it, to invite people in to co-create that vision being better, right? To be more inclusive in that leadership and get the most out of people. Is this the kind of a person that people feel that their energy is lifted when they're around them? Right? Because you need to make sure that that eminence from a leader lifts people's energy and gets them through the tough times, particularly in healthcare that we're going to have in times of crisis like we saw during the pandemic, right? So I think that the competencies we look for might be a little different than that command and control expertise that we would have looked at otherwise.
That's great. So you talk about and you unpack kind of some shifts that we need to make in your book, Never Lead Alone. And I'm curious if you will share what, you know, one or two of examples of these shifts.
Yeah, thank you. You know, as I was mentioning, the book is now being used by hospital systems like Baptist Health down in Miami and that region, right? Sharp Healthcare out in San Diego. And the way I wrote the book was every chapter is a shift that a team needs to make, that a leader needs to get a team to make. And every chapter is really short, just, you know, less than 15 pages. And every chapter has a few practices. So I'll give you one of the big shifts, moving from conflict avoidance to candor. The highest performing teams can say it all in the room, not behind each other's back. The highest performing teams wrestle ideas and push each other to higher levels of performance. They don't talk behind each other's back or have the meeting after the meeting. So if that's a shift, what's a good practice? Well, there's one thing that I do. I teach leaders called a candor break. What if right in the middle of a conversation that you're having with your team, the leader pauses and says, what's not being said right now that needs to be said? Now, instead of just asking, well, instead of just asking a group of folks, the leader pauses and said, I want you to just turn to the person next to you, and I want you to agree to one or two things that need to be said in this room that aren't being said, and then I want you to report out. Because if you were just to say to a group of six people, what's not being said that should be said, you're going to hear crickets. But if you assign them and say, I'm putting you into three groups of two, you're gonna talk about what's not being said. We're going to come back in the room and we're going to share what's not being said, what needs to be said. Then you get the answer. People are acquiescent to assignments. People will do their assignments. So we need to change the cultures that we want to have into simple assignments. Make it a protocol. So in the middle of every meeting, you do a candor break. That's game changing.
Yeah,
so it's simple practices.
Yeah, Keith, I love the example of the candor break. Can you give us an example where you've seen that really transform a team or make a big impact?
Every single day. Every single day. I mean, I imagine any of us sitting in a room where the leader is hell-bent on an agenda. And the team is not saying anything because they know that the leader may or may not want to hear it. And frankly, they know as well that there's other parts of the organization that are crucial that are also not on board. We've all been in those situations.
Yes.
And you do a candor break and all of a sudden everybody, you know, somebody reports out, we don't have alignment around this initiative, right? We don't have alignment around this initiative. And now we're faced with the grisly, ugly truth sitting there and we need to deal with it. So it's like they're very simple, you know, every single meeting, there's going to be something that needs to be on the table that we just haven't had the courage to squeeze the juice out of the room.
And so when we have these kind of candid conversations or candor, does it help? You mentioned alignment. Is that what the goal is to get really that team aligned towards the goal or the vision?
High performing teams ultimately are trying to drive high performing outcomes. So if we don't have alignment, we're going to have dispersed resources and focused on different stuff. And as a result, there's going to be an elongation of getting those outcomes, maybe never. So speed to getting outcomes, alignment's crucial. But that's only one of the things, right? We need to make sure we have bold ideas that are going to move the needle. I've seen teams working earnestly on an initiative. And the reality is that their aspiration or dream is 10x what that initiative is ever going to manifest. But nobody has stopped to say, we're working on this, but I don't think this is ever going to get us to the number we're looking for this year in terms of new patients or whatever it is. So it's like we've got to keep pausing every once in a while and taking a reality check. If we're trying to get these outcomes, is what we're doing and how we're doing is going to get us there? And I generally believe in the wisdom of the crowd. I think within every team, the wisdom is there, but it's just not put on the table.
Yeah, I want to piggyback on that because I think that's certainly true for healthcare, right? We get to work with some of the smartest folks, physicians, physical therapists, nurses, all, you know, today there's more and more doctorate degrees in every division.
Yeah.
So many smart individuals. And so I love your comments around the power of the team and getting the wisdom, the collective wisdom. Bill, what do you think?
Well, Keith, you know, one of the things that really resonated with me is you're talking about, you know, you take the pause and you want to make a candor break. What about when you're in the middle of an intervention? You're talking about people feeling like they can speak up and provide immediate feedback in situations, I mean, whether they're life-threatening or not. How do you go about encouraging that behavior?
Again, I feel that we often have these aspirations of what we hope people will do in their best selves, and then people fail us because the reality is we don't have the psychological safety. That's we have a historical culture that's different than what we're asking for, etc. I would say, you know, Dr. Cloud, think about how do you turn what your wish is into some form of an assignment. So you're in, you know, again, the idea of a candor break isn't that I'm just hopeful that everybody will be candid. I've seen tons of teams that have been trained in courageous dialogue and then don't do it when they get back into the OR. But if as a leader, pause in the middle of some intervention and say, okay, I need to hear the truth that's going to address this problem from each of you, go into groups of two, have a dialogue around what it is, and then let's restart the conversation. The reason that's important, because very few people will by themselves take the big risk of speaking truth to power. But if you assign them in groups of two and they've had that dialogue, now there feels like corroboration and there's more psychological safety. Psychological safety, which we all know, it's, you know, the ability to be courageous, etc. You know, it's that quieting of that reptilian brain. Psychological safety goes up 85% in small group dialogue. If you ask a group of people to just answer and nobody's going to do it, only the most courageous or the most foolish will answer. But if you ask each group to pair off, talk logically, get some corroboration and some courage from their peer, then report back, it's game changing. Simple act of a new process. This is what I learned back in my day of TQM and Six Sigma. Like where we're running process improvement, when we're running agile, all these other business processes, we need to turn culture into process. And so just adopting a simple practice is what changes culture. It's a bunch of values. It's a bunch of airy words. Look, I'm a blue collar steel kid from Pittsburgh. Just give me the practice. You know, get it into reality for me. Teach me how to do it. It's about practice and process.
Let me ask you a question that's going to sound foolish, I know. Do you have people who are confused when they receive feedback? They'll come back to you and say, "But you never told me that. I've never gotten any feedback from you about anything like that." How do you handle those situations?
Yeah. You know, part of it is multiple data points. So one of the things I do when I'm leading a team is I'll practice something called an open 360. We all know what a 360 degree review is. It's when HR comes in and interviews everybody and then shares with you what everybody has said about you. And it's confidential and it feels creepy. I think teams should be giving each other that kind of feedback all the time. So what we do is let's pretend we're a team for a second, you know, Skip, Brad, Dr. Cloud, we're all together. We'd start with each of you going around and saying, "Keith, what I most appreciate about you on this team is X." Boom, boom, boom. Each of you would share. And then you'd say, "Keith, because I care about your success, over the next couple of months, I might suggest." Boom, boom, boom. So if I hear a set of data from my peers, a corroborated set of data, multiple data points, I start getting more comfortable with the flow of information, right? Then if something is said to me that is opposite of what my belief is in myself, I'm not as intimidated. It's all just data that I get to analyze. and I can certainly ask questions. Well, Dr. Cloud, you suggested that I need to speak less in meetings because I'm taking up too much airtime. That's great, but can you give me an example of that? Could you point it out to me? Or I always thought that I was being courageous in my dialogue and you're asking me to speak less. Tell me what's the difference. Like, I can ask good questions, not be defensive. We've got to start turning feedback into a perception of data, not directive. And if you don't mind, I'll just add to that.
That's really
good. All our life, we've been taught that anytime we get feedback, we got to do something with it. Like, I got six boys. None of them ever thought they were getting feedback. For me, they were getting directives. Sit up straight. Don't eat that way, etc. They go to school. They get their coaches. Their coaches are giving them directives. Their bosses give them directives. Now, all of a sudden, we want everybody to give you feedback 360. You get scared. You're like, holy cow, how do I take all those directives? What if they're conflicting? We've got to start teaching people that to give feedback is to give bold input, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that input turns into a directive. So we need to start realizing.
Keith, just to make sure I understand, I really like this point. Or not every piece of data now requires an action or a reaction.
No.
It's just data in, right?
It's data in.
Yeah.
And when it's coming from peers, it also helps to be less defensive. If all of a sudden I'm sitting there realizing that everybody's giving me input, but they know that their input isn't a directive, it's just input, it's courage on both sides. Like, I'd be more willing to take a risk and tell Brad what I'm really thinking, because Brad, listen, I love you, brother, and you know, this is just input. You do what you want to with it. Yeah. Corroborate it with other data, do whatever you want. This is just input. I'm not giving you a directive. So to start getting units of teams willing to give each other input, the bolder the better, and trust that each person will take all that input and analyze it. Now look, there's this thing called a boss. And when the boss is watching this whole thing, if Keith's getting input week after week after week that he's not taking, there's a different conversation to have. It's a performance conversation. But right now we're talking about this thing called giving peers, giving feedback. That's just input. So we need to start developing a new set of language. This gets back to the fact that most leaders are not taught to develop teamship. This idea of saying to your team, I want you to give each other feedback, but you need to realize it's only input. That's taught in chapter 3. Most leaders aren't taught that.
And it really requires leaders to have some humility for knowing that they don't have to have all the answers. You know, they can really glean some of that from the team. So I think that's great. I want to get to another one of the critical shifts that you talked about. Can you tell us a little bit about stress testing instead of reporting out?
Yeah, that is actually a practice in the same chapter. That's a practice in the candor chapter. So there's a chapter about moving from conflict avoidance to candor. A lot of us do report out. So let's say someone's been working on a new initiative in a new building initiative in an east wing of a hospital, right?
We do them all the time.
Yep. And you show up in a bunch of people and you'd start doing a report out. And you're clicking through a bunch of slides and half the people are doing texting. And most of the time you're clicking through the slides and you're only sharing the good stuff. So we have a new process. Next time you want to do a report out, do a stress test. The person has to show up and say, here's what I've achieved on this project, which could be up for debate. Here's where I'm struggling, which is important for that person to share where they need help. That's a whole social contract opening. And here's what I'm planning to do over the next month or two. And then everybody goes in a small breakout room and opens up a document and writes, here's what you're missing. Here's an idea for you. Here's where I could help. Now, again, you've just taken the culture you want to have and turned it into an assignment. You want to have a challenge culture? Assign people to challenge the stress test. You want to have a creative culture? Assign people to give creative ideas. You want to have a supportive culture? Assign people to write down where they could be helpful. So what we do again is, you know, very simple. I have looked at the highest performing teams in the world. I've identified what their practices are, and then I've extracted them and turned them into practices any team can follow. I think it's a pretty It's a pretty nifty piece of research I've been doing for 20 years. I haven't seen it done.
Yeah, it sounds really awesome and really applicable to where we are and what we're studying and learning. And again, I do think I like the way you've articulated that, you know, it's a change in leadership and leader structure for kind of how we show up. Who has to make the biggest shift today? Is it our workers or is it our leaders?
You know, the wonderful thing about this work is, of course, we want leaders to get this and drive it down. You know, but the good thing about this work is if anywhere you are, if you're a nurse in an ER, you could show up and say, hey, I've been working on something. Would y'all stress test it for me?
I love that.
Right. I mean, you can be the role model for your peers. It doesn't have to always be top down. You know, there's another thing I'd love to end on because I think we're probably, I know y'all are stressed on your time. You're trying to be as efficient as possible. Let me do one more. There's a whole chapter of talking about resilience. We saw during the pandemic a stressing of the healthcare workforce like we've never seen before. And that was extraordinary. Now, what we believe is that it's sad that we've come out of that and we've lost what used to happen. Remember, we used to show up and the first thing we would do is look at each other and say, is everybody okay? Mm-hmm. That's what we did during the pandemic. We stopped and we said, is everybody okay? Is everyone's mother okay? Is everybody okay? And I noticed that and I turned it into a practice that now I'm asking teams to do monthly energy checks. Everybody on the team goes around and says, on a scale of 0 to 5, my energy is X. And what's been bringing it down is this. And it could be that your mother's, you know, early dementia. It could be your kids off the rail. It could be just the stress of the workload. It could be that your hormones are going in a different direction. Whatever it is, it's like, here's what this month has been for me. And then you go around. Now, the key to this is, in the olden days, a good leader was expected to keep everybody's energy strong. How in the world do you do that? But what if the team knew that their responsibility was to keep each other's energy strong?
Powerful.
That way, and 3 weeks later, everybody could be checking in with Brad and say, hey, Brad, how'd your wife's procedure go? Right? This kind of stuff happens when you have a beautiful artist of a leader that creates an environment where you're naturally sharing all this stuff. But what if you don't? All you got to do is do an energy check once a month. And you'll start to have a collective esprit de corps of people having each other's back.
Keith, I love it. Bill, you got one more question for him?
Yeah, you're talking about the pandemic. And we've talked a lot about, Keith, that there are certain things that we did before the pandemic that are actually have gone away permanently. And we talk about this in terms of, you know, maybe we're never going to get as many nurses to work in hospitals as we did before. And so one of the challenges we have is trying to figure out, is that true or not? And then if it is true, then what? Because the teams, actually the members of the teams may look different going forward than they did 5 years ago. There may be. So, you know, one of the things we talk about is how do we identify the skill sets that are required to really have an effective healthcare team? I mean, we're really talking about getting back to basics now. And, are there other industries that have been through this? You talk about the steel industry in Pittsburgh. I mean, what can we learn from things that have been industry-wide changes?
So the first thing that I think we have to recognize is that the volatility of change, which is pretty high these days. And I do think that in the next 3 to 5 years with AI, we are about to see a significant change in our work processes and who's our team. I think we're going to start having teammates that are AI agents, not just individuals. And with that transformation of the makeup of the team, et cetera, we've got to start working in agile sprints. So agile is the operating system that any organization going through volatility has to practice. And the way I think about it is, each of us needs to ask ourselves, we've got a goal for the year, clinical goals and business goals, et cetera. What are our monthly goals? And at the end of every month, we need to pause and we need to ask the broadest audience that has a dog in the hunt. We have to ask them, what do you think about what we've been doing and where we need to go that needs to change in order for us to achieve what we're trying to achieve? And that idea of being open on a monthly basis for if agile sprints, being open to take in new information. Do we need the same people? Do we need different competencies? Are we keeping up with what the market's expecting of us so that we can then adjust and pivot on a monthly basis? Otherwise, we're going to wake up at the end of the year and we're going to fail. So I think it wasn't a direct answer, Dr. Cobb, but I think it's a process intervention, which is if you break your work down into monthly sprints and start being highly transparent and critical and ask ourselves, what do we need to change in the next month to make sure that we learn from last month's lessons and get on a track to success for the year? I think we'll answer a lot of those questions.
Thank you, Keith.
Fantastic, Keith. That was really, really good. You know, and everyone knows what a good team looks like when they see it. And we all like to go to sports because that's a fun thing. But even I've been watching binge watching Top Chef with my wife. And when you see a great team, it's pretty special. But it doesn't happen very often. And so this has been really good dialogue. And Keith, I hope that you'll be willing to maybe come back again and have further conversations with us. This was really healthy, really needed. But on behalf of Baptist Memorial Healthcare, we just want to say thank you so much for the leadership that that you're doing and all the great work that you're doing. And we're just so grateful for everything you're doing. Thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Truly my pleasure. Invite me down sometime to Memphis. I love that. I love your Southern food.
We'll make that happen.